From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Parts of the state are still without power as utilities try measures to avoid sparking wildfires. However, though it could limit fire risk, it won't limit the financial damages. Find out how much outages could cost Californians. Plus, the Dodgers are done, and after years of falling short of winning a World Series, should they rebuild or reload for next season? It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I mean, Martinez, I know the Dodgers, Well, at least try your best to have a happy Thursday. In about 10 minutes, we're going to talk more about what the offseason might bring. But first, the mass power shutoffs across the state. They're part of a larger effort to prevent wildfires as high winds sweep northern and southern California. Now, to that end, Southern California Edison says it's cut power to nearly 13,000 customers in four counties, including Los Angeles, San Bernardino, and Ventura. Up north, well, much more. At least 600,000 customers of Pacific Gas and Electric are without power. We spoke earlier today with two people affected by the outages, and they told us this.
Having power go out, I just realized that how much you're at the mercy of PG&E just to get through your daily life. The thing that seemed odd about it for us was they just sprung it on us at the last minute and said there might be a few hours, you know, after midnight, and then it progressed to a 26-hour situation.
I work at a tennis club. On a typical Wednesday, we have 50 kids come in for different tennis lesson programs. All 50 of those kids were impacted yesterday and their families. In the future, I certainly am thinking about a generator. And I think more and more people will be doing that as we, you know, find out whether or not this is going to become a more normal part of our lives.
That was Dean Schubert in Eureka, California, and Aaron Morales in Santa Rosa. While the shutoff efforts are aimed at preventing loss of property and life, they're not without cost. One Stanford energy professor even gave it a dollar figure, about $1.8 billion a day. Peter Larson specializes in economics of power outages at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Peter, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I'll start off right off by saying that human lives are the most important in all of this. But there are economic effects, too. Those could last a long time. So let's start with the who of this. Who takes a financial hit in a blackout?
Well, the way we think about it are sort of direct and indirect impacts. And direct impacts include, you know, costs to customers, residential customers, commercial and industrial customers take immediately and throughout an eruption that may last, in this case, more than a day.
So we're talking like spoilage of food, things like that?
Yeah, for a typical residential customer, if the interruption is less than a day, yeah, these are the typical things we see are, you know, spoilage of food, also, you know, some inconvenience where, you know, maybe you have to drive down to a coffee shop to get internet access and do your work. With commercial industrial, that's a whole other element that's important to mention. And commercial and industrial customers, if they don't have forms of backup generation, can take cases massive losses in terms of lost productivity and lost revenue, especially if the interruption lasts longer than, you know, a few hours or days.
Now, at your lab, you helped develop a calculator that puts a dollar value on loss. It's based on customer surveys taken by utility companies. An energy scholar at Stanford used the calculator and then came up with that figure that I mentioned up top, $1.8 billion for 600,000 people over 24 hours. I know you'll still have to do an official investigation, but does this sound like it's right in the ballpark in terms of figures?
Well, it's hard to say. I can tell you with, you know, pretty high degree of certainty, costs are going to be significant. And it doesn't take heroic assumptions we developed, which is called a cost estimation calculator. It doesn't take heroic assumptions, the losses, the direct costs to customers exceeding $1 billion. So, you know, we're a bit cautious at this point, and I think there are a couple of reasons we're cautious. One being that the outages are still have good information about the type of customers that are without power. If it's a large number of residential customers, you get one economic estimate. If you have a bigger share of commercial and industrial customers where there can be massive economic losses, that, you know, can add, you know, an order of magnitude to the costs. And so we'll plan on working with the U.S. Department of Energy and other colleagues and our friends at consulting firms to investigate this down the road.
Talking to Peter Larson. He specializes in the economics of power outages at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. And Peter, in case people are wondering, the little blips that people are hearing have nothing to do with the power outages. Your connection is just digital, so that's why they're hearing that. Now, it's worth noting that fires themselves can lead to power outages. It's also worth reiterating that preventing loss of life is also the goal. But for companies like PG&E in the short term, are there some other ideas they might consider?
Yeah, definitely. In the short term, you know, there are some strategies that the utilities are already working on and implementing, and heard about some of those leading up to this interview here. Utilities only up their what we call vegetation management practices. That means they tree trim, cutting back shrubs. They can increase the amount of activity in that space. They already do that their, you know, day-to-day reliability, but, you know, the more you can eliminate the fire hazard before it starts is really important, and also prevent it from spreading. The other thing is, again, deploying more weather sensors all along the circuits, all lines, whether they're transmission or distribution lines. The more information they can get about when the conditions may be ripe for an ignition, the better. They can then strategically de-energize the lines to de-energizing large sections of transmission and distribution lines that could, you know, serve in some cases tens of thousands of customers. And then what we're seeing in Northern California, and it sounds like there is a potential in Southern California, is, you know, the last resort, which is de-energizing lines to prevent public and private property damage, but also the possibility of loss of life.
Thinking more long-term, Peter, what does PG&E need to do?
Well, PG&E is not unique. There are a number of utilities struggling with wildfire challenges. And then, you know, outside of the West, we have other types of events like hurricanes that utilities are, you know, have some experience dealing with, but there are more and more challenges starting to materialize. And so for a company like PG&E or SoCal Edison or San Diego Gas and Electric, the things they think about, are undergrounding power lines, which is a costly solution, but it also produces some economic benefits. Another long-term strategy is, you know, continuing to encourage what we call distributed energy resources. These are behind-the-meter types of energy resources like solar PV and batteries. The more you have those, the less you have the need for overhead lines nearby that may be a source of an ignition for a fire. And finally, I think this is PG&E in that, you know, we should be thinking about laws and regulations about building in wildland-urban interfaces where these typically ignite. We have thought about, you know, you can't build in a floodplain. There isn't as much discussion about you shouldn't be building right up along, you know, of dense vegetation. And so those are some things that PG&E and the broader collection of society can be thinking about.
Peter Larson specializes in the economics of power outages at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Peter, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, while parts of California don't have power, there was plenty of it last night at Dodger Stadium in a playoff series deciding game between the Dodgers and the Washington Nationals. Dodgers hit a pair of home runs early. They had a 3-1 lead heading into the top of the eighth inning, but that's when the Nationals slugged back, hitting two whoppers off of pitcher Clayton Kershaw to tie and send the game into extra innings. Then in the 10th, this happened.
This is deep to center field. Bellinger's back. It's a grand slam! Howie Kendrick to break it open. Behind second, caught by Michael A. Taylor, and the Washington Nationals, they beat the Dodgers.
The lights were still on, but the air had definitely left the building as the Dodgers, a team that won a franchise record 106 games in the regular season, had been to back-to-back World Series, are done, eliminated, waiting until next year, but have a whole lot of questions to ponder until then. And we're going to ask some of those questions to David Vasse, the host of Dodger Talk on AM 570 LA Sports. David, welcome back.
Thanks, A. Appreciate it.
Now, in your job, you are embedded with the Dodgers 24-7. From spring training, every day of the season, you're on the team bus, plane, hotels, the clubhouse, the whole thing. Ultimately, this year, they did not win the World Series, just like last year and the year before. What makes this loss this year different?
Well, because they knocked on the door two straight years going to the World Series, and the expectations, as you know, in Los Angeles with the Dodgers is to win the championship, and that's something that has not happened in a very long time. To be exact, it has not happened since 1988. So the expectations were very high, especially after the team won a franchise record 106 games in the regular season. In fact, this is the first time in all of baseball history that a team that won that many games was eliminated in the divisional round. And talking to a lot of people around baseball, it's not a surprise the Nationals pushed the Dodgers to the limits and eventually eliminated them. I guess the biggest surprise and disappointment is the way it happened last night. That's not the way many people thought the Dodgers would lose to the Nationals. They would envision the starting pitcher for the Nationals, Steven Strasburg, pitching eight scoreless innings and shutting down the offense. They would not imagine Walker Buehler matching him pitch for pitch and Howie Kendrick hitting a grand slam in the 10th inning.
And there are two other names Dodger fans are talking about right now. That's pitcher Clayton Kershaw and manager Dave Roberts. Let's start with Kershaw. He's won three Cy Young Awards as baseball's best pitcher, a National League Most Valuable Player in 2014. He's an eight-time All-Star. I mean, I think if he quit today, he's a surefire Hall of Famer already. But his playoff performances have been shaky and starkly subpar compared to what he does in the regular season. David, you've gotten to know Clayton Kershaw over the years. How much does this weigh on him?
So much so, talking to one of his close confidants and one of his former teammates today, they told me he has not returned their texts. So that tells me that he is still reeling from last night. And you saw the body language in the dugout. He did not move from his spot after returning from the mound, a defeated man. And even as his teammates were on the top rail, he was still stunned and sulking on the bench there in his jacket. So I think he was shell-shocked, and honestly, this will be his longest off-season, in my opinion, of any of the other postseason failures where he had to reflect on what took place, because he inherited a 3-1 lead. It's not like he started the game and slowly gave it away. I think that's easier for him to swallow. What's tough for him to swallow in this situation is he took a great performance from Walker Buehler and was not able to hold on to the lead. Now, keep in mind, too, Clayton Kershaw has never done what he tried to do last night. Yes, he's pitched in relief in the past, but he has never come into the game out of the bullpen to pitch to one hitter, sit down, and then come back to try to complete the next inning. He has never done that in his career. He was put in a situation that he has never succeeded or even attempted before in his career. And he is not the same Clayton Kershaw that we saw 5 years ago. No. He's throwing a mortal 89 to 91 mile an hour fastball that guys like Anthony Rendon and Juan Soto are not going to miss if they're on the heart of the plate. And that's what happened last night on back-to-back pitches that literally brought him to his knees.
Talking to David Vasse, host of Dodger Talk on AM 570 LA Sports. David, you take calls from fans after every game. What are you hearing from Dodger fans about Kershaw? I mean, he's a guy who's really gotten himself involved in the fabric of Los Angeles.
Yeah, I think Dodger fans are frustrated with a lot of his postseason shortcomings, and that's to put it kindly. But I believe the Dodger fans are realistic over the fact that Father Time is winning the battle on Clayton Kershaw, and he should not be expected to shoulder the burden of trying to come out of the bullpen and be the savior for the Dodgers in a lot of different ways. That time has passed in his career, and Dodger fans realize that, especially with the tone of the phone calls last night. They definitely were angry. Some were emotional, so much so some said they wanted him traded. I don't believe that's something in 2 months from now people will still want, but in the moment, a lot of fans were emotional over the fact that he let another playoff series slip away.
Well, now to the guy who left him in there in the eighth inning. That's manager Dave Roberts. In four seasons, he's won 100 games twice, but lost the World Series twice, and now what happened yesterday. And there's that old baseball saying, David, I'm sure you know it, that managers get hired to get fired. Overall, how much of the Dodgers' big picture is on Dave Roberts?
Well, he's the manager, and I know it's fashionable to point the finger to Andrew Friedman, who is the president of baseball operations, who is heavily involved in the pregame planning of every postseason game and, for that matter, the regular season. There's no doubt about it. There is a collaboration going on before the game, but as the game is unfolding, Andrew Friedman is not calling the dugout to tell Dave Roberts what to do. So ultimately, it was his call to send Clayton Kershaw back out there after he struck out Adam Eaton, had the crowd, had the momentum on his side, to send Kershaw out there to do something that he has never done in the regular season or the postseason in his career, to try to come back after sitting down to pitch another inning of relief. So that was his decision, and I would say, judging by the tone of the calls, more fans are pointing the finger at Dave Roberts than they are at Clayton Kershaw, even though it's pretty close at this point in time.
One more thing, David. Got about a minute left. You mentioned Andrew Friedman, the Dodgers president of baseball operations. His five-year contract with the Dodgers expired last night. This is it. What are the chances of maybe a top-down evaluation by the team's owners? Mark Walter, controlling partner of Guggenheim, who owns the Dodgers, of the entire Dodgers on-field product.
I'm sure he's doing that, and I know Mark is a big fan, but from what I've been told over the last 2 weeks, it is imminent that the Dodgers will be retaining Andrew Friedman, and the Boston Red Sox have been waiting to interview candidates and make a final decision on who will take their spot, and they are waiting to see whether or not Andrew Friedman is available, but from what I'm being told, he's not going anywhere.
That's David Vasse, host of Dodger Talk on AM 570 LA Sports. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
Candidates running for office will say just about anything to get elected, and while you try to figure out if they really mean what they say and have real policies behind their promises, they move on to the next stop and the next group of potential voters to charm. Coming up, the Democratic presidential candidates are in Los Angeles today, speaking to a specific group of people and the issues that are critically important to them. Find out who they are and what they hope to hear when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Tonight, several Democratic presidential candidates will be in downtown L.A. for a town hall on LGBTQ rights. They include Vice President Joe Biden, or former Vice President Joe Biden, Senators Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren. It's one of the handful of times that many of these folks will be in Southern California, and is also the first ever televised presidential event focused on LGBTQ issues. It'll air on CNN. So what are the voters looking for from the candidates tonight? And we wanted to find out. We invited a couple of people to our studio today who plan to be at the event. And that's Miche Pulido with the Trans-Latina Coalition and Ryan Basham. He's with the Stonewall Democratic Club that's based in L.A. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Hi, thank you.
Now, we should note that both of you are voicing your own opinions. You're not speaking on behalf of your organizations, but let's start with candidate preference. Do you have a clear favorite already? And if you do, why? Miche, let's start with you.
So I think presidential races have always been really difficult for me and difficult for the trans community. It's really difficult to know who's actually going to prioritize the community and not only use this as a platform for their win. That's a lot of the fear for community and a lot of fear for me in thinking about who I would like to endorse. But if there would have to be people that I was promoting or that I was choosing to support. There's pros and cons to everyone. I think Elizabeth Warren has been really intentional in not only reaching out to me, but to our organization, Trans Latina Coalition, and are really reaching out to people on the ground and not just the national, like, DC organizations, but the people that are actually providing, like, life-saving services.
And I wish, you know, the listeners could see your face, Misha, because you have trouble trusting, it sounds like.
Like, the idea of centralizing power in one person is, I think, a flawed system. I think there's no entire way for one person to really represent the rights and the needs and providing leadership opportunities to our community.
All right, Ryan Basham, what about you? Who do you like so far and why?
Well, ditto everything you just said about representation. Even up until Barack Obama, there were plenty of things that could have been done that weren't. I think the entire community is always an afterthought, or we matter most when it's time to vote. But I will say, I don't have a clear favorite. I will say A, not you, A.
I will take your vote.
You can have it. Yeah. I'm encouraged by one of our own being in the running and a serious contender.
Pete Buttigieg, you're talking about.
Yes, Pete Buttigieg. Yes. And, but other than that, I think I was encouraged by Elizabeth Warren going out of her way to both know and name the trans black women who have been murdered so far this year, which indicates to me that at a minimum, she has people on her team who are paying enough attention to the details that we as activists pay attention
exactly.
to.
So you just mentioned Elizabeth Warren. Let's listen to that moment at the LGBTQ forum that happened 3 weeks ago. I mean, she seemed to make a lot of impact, starting not with a speech, but instead reading off the names of 18 people.
18 trans women of color who have been killed so far this year. It is time for a president of the United States of America to say their names.
Misha, what did that mean to you as a voter to hear Elizabeth Warren, a presidential candidate, say those names?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's amazing that she was able to uplift the violence that's happening to black trans women. But also, like, it's not that monumental because this is something that I'm living every day and something that I'm hearing every day. And so, great, you're acknowledging it, but, like, what are your solutions to ultimately saving the lives of black trans women? But we also need to be talking about the violence that trans immigrant women are experiencing. And within that list, who's often forgotten is the two trans women that have died in immigration detention. Her name was Joanna Medina and the other one was Roxana Hernandez. And these are also two people that are rarely acknowledged. And so I think...
But you said that's the least a presidential candidate can do. Is that all you've been getting so far from the presidential candidates, the least they could do?
Until I see some action, yeah. Right now, it's all kind of lip service. Like, yes, they're reaching out to us for feedback, but I haven't really seen any sort of action yet.
So when you hear candidates talk about LGBTQ rights, what are the nuances that you're listening for to signal that this person is genuine?
Paying attention to the details that we pay attention to in terms of specifically trans women of color, as an example, being murdered. That's a specific detail that activists pay attention to that most people aren't even aware of. But I also think, you know, what a president does normalizes. So if a president goes out of their way to treat LGBTQ people as normal, to go out of their way to talk about us, to talk with us, to include us, to give visibility to members of our community, that makes a difference in terms of the way that people, members of our community, are treated every day. It's like when you disrespect your friend on accident. You kind of go out of your way the next time an opportunity comes up to make sure they feel seen and heard and loved. That's kind of what the stage that the LGBTQ community is in. I think that right now we need to be, as a society, going out of our way to include the LGBTQ community so that eventually it's not a big deal, but it's not a big deal yet.
What I can hope is that people will change their mindsets about who trans people are and actually realize that we're full beings and don't deserve to be treated and like burned in cars and shot and all of these other things that people deem to be normal, right?
So if white working class Americans in the Midwest get discussed over and over again because we lost their votes in 2016, then we should be talking about trans people, we should be talking about queer people, we should be talking about immigrants just as much.
We're talking about where the presidential candidates stand on LGBTQ issues, and we're talking about it with Misha Pulido with the Trans Latina Coalition and also Ryan Basham with the Stonewall Democratic Club. Now, in the spectrum of the candidates that are out there, how similar are they on the values that you're looking for? Would you be happy, ultimately, with any of them in the end, Misha?
I mean, ultimately, like, we're going to have to be happy with someone because someone is going to be chosen. But like I said, there are pros and cons to everyone. For example, Kamala Harris is from here, or at least represents California as a senator. But she has also said really transphobic things, saying that folks can't have access to surgeries when incarcerated, and has had really transphobic moments in her career. And those are things you can't forget. And then when she's called out on it, retracts the statement, but it was still said. The same thing with Pete. He also had really rigid views on voting rights for incarcerated people. And I think what's important is transparency among anyone in society, especially a presidential candidate.
Now, Ryan, what about you? Of all the candidates out there, how similar are they in the values you're looking for?
I think a wet paper bag would do a better job on our issues, would do a better job with the economy, would do a better job with foreign policy. So I'm going to work my butt off as a volunteer for whoever gets the nomination. But there are definitely some that are better than others. I think I completely agree. I think things that Kamala Harris has said, I think things that Tulsi Gabbard has said and done are really disheartening. And none of these people have modeled what it is to appropriately apologize and model changing your mind for the American public. I mean, it's a lot of defensiveness. There's no, I said it or I did it. I'm sorry. None of them have really done that yet. So I'm looking for candidates who are demonstrating for others how to be allies from the podium. And, off the top of my head, I think Pete Buttigieg is an ally because he's one of us. And Elizabeth Warren is doing a great job by naming people by name. And after that, it remains to be seen.
So you mentioned Buttigieg. He's an ally because he's one of us, you said. Does that mean anything to get your vote?
No, because, it's not as if he's progressive on all the issues. And we don't know. One of the things Barack Obama was criticized for was not doing enough for the black community because the perception was he didn't want to be perceived as too black. It's possible that Pete Buttigieg will get elected and he'll go out of his way to not do too much for us because he doesn't want to be perceived as too gay. So he has not addressed that well enough for me.
I think the LGBT community gets seen as a lump, but I think the LGB community is a very separate community than the trans community. And when you think about the whole acronym, the fact that he's a part of the acronym and he's gay is, like I said, really important for visibility and would be monumental being a gay person. But I've seen that not always do the entire LGBT spectrum of people always support trans people in the ways that we need them to. And so I wouldn't say that their identity is something that would make me vote for them. It's really about how they're taking accountability for things that they said and how they're planning to incorporate all the letters within our spectrum of identities.
One more thing for both of you. You had to pick your top issue that you'll be listening for tonight. What is it? Amisha, let's start with you.
I think there needs to be a specific focus when we think about LGBT people around trans rights and what we're going to do to really focus on improving the conditions that trans people are facing. Trans people are behind economically, politically, socially, and really thinking about the system that allows for people to get justice for the murders that have happened. None of the trans women that have died have gotten justice for their deaths.
Ryan, what about you? Top issue you'll be listening for tonight?
Until a presidential candidate demonstrates that they get all of our issues across the entire spectrum and that they have a comprehensive plan for not just solving them in law, but solving them in practice. No one in my book will have done enough. So I'm looking for the closest thing to that marker that we can get from them this evening.
Ryan Basham, Stonewall Democratic Club, Misha Pulido, Trans Latina Coalition. Ryan, Misha, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
California farms have a long list of things they grow that people all over the world enjoy. Now, a long time ago in LA, we had a different kind of farm, one whose signature product you could hear on a movie screen. Find out what it is when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. If you're a movie fan like I am, chances are you're probably familiar with this sound. For those who didn't catch it, that's the roaring lion featured during Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's movie openings. You're probably familiar with Leo the Lion, the name of the MGM mascot, but you might not know the story behind the lion farm. That's right, the lion farm that supplied the big cats. And that's what we're talking about today on Throwback Thursday.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
Kim Cooper is with Esoteric Tours. She's here to tell us the story of Gay's Lion Farm. Welcome back, Kim.
Oh, happy to be here.
All right. A lion farm in Southern California. Sounds far-fetched, but it really, really existed. What's the story of how it even came to be?
It is wacky, but it's a typically Southern Californian story of a couple of European immigrants, Charles and Muriel Gay. He was a circus performer and an animal trainer from France, and he happened to be performing in England, met a young female journalist who really took to him, and they decided to throw their lot in together and come to Southern California and reinvent themselves. And they arrived with three lions, and three lions soon became many more lions. He had a vision as a trainer. He thought that lions were actually pretty dumb animals. They were trainable, but if you had an adult lion, it was always going to be stuck in its ways and a little bit unpredictable. But if you started with a baby and you bottle fed it and you loved it and you learned its personality and you specifically picked out the lions that were the most trainable and malleable, you could create motion picture stars, and that's what he did.
Wow. So what years are we talking about here?
So they arrive in 1914, and by 1924, they have so many lions that the notion of staying in the heart of Los Angeles is just not feasible. So they do what all wise Angelenos do. They go to El Monte.
Yeah.
5 acres in El Monte.
So that's where they set up their farm.
That's where they set up their farm.
All right. Now, were exotic animals common back in the early 20s when the lion farm first came about? Were people just doing that all over the place?
Yeah. They weren't new, but by any stretch, the notion of having a place where you could go and see specific animals. There was the Costin Ostrich Ranch, which was in South Pasadena, and that dates back to the late 19th century fad for ostrich plumes. And then in Lincoln Park, there was an alligator farm.
Alligator farm, huh?
Yeah, and I'm so happy that as a young kid who was obsessed with reptiles, I got to visit the remnants of this, where it moved to Buena Park over near Knott's, and it was still there for a little while in the 1970s, so I got to visit the end of that. But you know, the lion farm was very different because they weren't interested in necessarily culling these animals, you know, for meat or for their skins. You know, it was a combination zoo and actors.
So was it like a modern day zoo, like someone would know maybe the L.A. Zoo, or was there more to it? I mean, set the scene for us. What would it have been like to visit way back in the day?
Okay, well, you would arrive at what looked like an African hacienda, very much in the architectural style of some of the buildings that you see at Adventureland, Disneyland. And yeah. I do think that that's not coincidental. And when you would walk in, you'd actually be walking into the Gay's home. But you could also buy your 50-cent ticket and continue through to a large open area, which was filled with cages. There was a U-shaped performance venue in the very center. And Mr. Gay would be there in his classic, well-tailored lion tamer's attire, and he would give you a tour. He would show you his wife, who was bottle-feeding the infants. They were fed on a mixture of goat's milk with a little bit of lime and eggs mixed in.
Wow, okay.
He would talk to you about some of the famous lions, like Slats and Numa. You know, he had numerous lions with different personalities. And, you know, then you could see, for instance, a performance involving feeding the lions.
So it sounds like there was a lot of showmanship involved.
Yeah, they had feedings by the hour. They would actually go through two horses a day. And they would occasionally do things that were really sort of oddball. Like one of the feedings, they would push out into the center of the U-shaped compound an open safari car filled with mannequins who were, you know, just sitting there waiting. And their clothing was stuffed with horse meat. So when they would turn the lions loose, they would actually be torn to ribbons and the crowd would gasp.
I'm just picturing that for a second, Kim. I mean, if a kid, a little kid, isn't prepared, they could be terrified by this.
Scarred for life. But it's showmanship.
Yeah.
And you paid
so,
your 50 cents, you know?
Yeah.
If you don't like it, go look at the cubs.
I guess so. Did they also do typical things that maybe you'd see lions do at a circus?
Oh, yeah. They had lions who could balance on a barrel. They had lions who could walk on a... Well, not one tightrope. They actually used two.
Okay.
But come on, it's a lion. I mean, it's got four legs. I'm impressed by that.
Yeah.
They had lions that could stand up and sort of dance with Mr. Gay. They had lions who were trained if Mrs. Gay lay down in the center of one of the cages, they would just come and very gently lower their body on top of her.
Now, you mentioned that the lion farm actually was established at the dawn of the movie industry. How did it come to supply the iconic lions for the MGM studio production logo?
Well, I don't know exactly how that commission happened, but I mean, if you're going to get a lion in Southern California, you're going to call Mr.
Place,
Gay,
right?
And he's got beautiful lions to choose from. You could actually pick, you know, the most handsome and well-maned lion. In this case, they picked a lion named Slats, who was sort of one of their famous, more beautiful lions, and he had a lovely roar. The nice thing about doing movie work at Gay's, remember, it's 5 acres. It's beautifully landscaped. They have a lot of jungle-style plantings, so you can create an environment that seems like it could be Africa or India or wherever you think you want to have lions in your movies. I guess more likely Africa. And they also had these stunt cages so that you could be filming and it could appear that your actor was very close to the lion, but because of motion picture trickery, they actually weren't in any danger.
Now, okay, Gay's Lion Farm obviously no longer exists. What
happened
to it? I'm sorry,
it's not. Well, remember I said that they go through 2 horses a day, and there were meat shortages and actually rationing during World War II. This becomes a problem when you have 200 adult lions who expect to be fed on the hour, except on Mondays. The lions were fasted on Mondays for their health, and they would roar, and they would be heard all across the San Gabriel Valley. But still, that's an awful lot of meat. And for a while, they were able to go on despite these restrictions because farmers in the community really, you know, loved and cared for the Gays and wanted them to go on. And so they would donate animals. But it became harder and the Gays were getting older. So a decision was made in 1942 that they would shut down for the duration of the war. And some of their lions were sold and others were given to zoos or loaned out temporarily. But by the time the war ended, Mr. Gay was in ill health and he just didn't feel like he had the energy to, you know, recreate his entire world. So that was the end of it.
Now, what's the legacy of Gay's Lion Farm that it leaves behind?
Well, unlike some really bizarre and wonderful bits of the past, like, for instance, the alligator farm, you'll find no remnants of that really to speak of in Lincoln Park today. There actually are some cool remnants of lions in El Monte. Most notably, if you go to the bottom of Peck Road, right where the 10 freeway crosses it, which was the site of the gate of the lion farm, there's a lovely crouching statue of one of the lions, which originally stood outside, and it's behind a decorative gate that has silhouettes of lions. I mean,
I've wondered about that.
Well, next time you should park at the McDonald's, which used to be part of the Gay's Lion Farm facility too, and walk over and really soak it up. And you can also go to El Monte High School, and they have a larger, more stylized lion sculpture that used to be at Gay's. But that one I'm not as fond of because my understanding is that in the late 1970s, pranksters put a grenade in its mouth and blew its head off. Geez. So it's a replica.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that one suffered badly. But I think that's great. And there's still, you know, the El Monte Lions is the name of the school team, and the lions are something that El Monte remembers and is proud of, and I think it's one of the greatest parts of Southern California lore.
And again, it's a quirky slice of L.A. life, what the promise of L.A. and Southern California was.
Yeah, and it's a family business, and it would never have happened if these two people hadn't fallen in love and had this vision. And here in Southern California, you can just do things that you could never do anywhere else. If they had stayed in England or in France, I really don't see the Lion Farm taken off.
More than likely not. Kim Cooper is with Esoteric Tour. She's here today speaking about Gay's Lion Farm. Kim, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Used to be, if you wanted to explore space as an astronaut, you had to do it through NASA. That is so 1960s of you. That's because these days, space travel is kind of a private business thing. Coming up, we'll go live to SpaceX in Hawthorne to hear how close things are to sending you and me to the stars. That's next in 60 seconds. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. We've been monitoring the power shutoffs down here in Southern California. Now, currently about 13,000 customers in 4 counties are without power right now. That includes Los Angeles. San Bernardino is also affected, and that includes the Cal State campus there. Students are, not surprisingly, frustrated. Adonis Galarza Toledo is the student body president at Cal State San Bernardino.
The campus did announce the campus closure at 7:30 a.m. and the first round of classes began at 8 a.m. So students who were traveling from afar, you know, they got a notice right before they got to campus, which is pretty unfortunate. A lot of people had exams and projects, and a lot of things that were due today. We're paying for an education. We're paying to go to school. And it's unfortunate that we're getting a day less of service because of this issue.
The move to shut off power is a preventative measure to try and keep wildfires at bay. Already today, we're seeing blazes start up in areas like Fontana and Moreno Valley. No causes have been identified, but the weather isn't helping. It's hot and dry, and those Santa Ana winds are a-blowing. From our archives, a profile on those wild winds.
Santa Ana wind event and the fact that the heat will be on.
Winds there pack the power of a hurricane.
Red flag warnings for many areas of the Southland.
And that's going to make the fire danger pretty bad over the next couple of days.
We hear a lot about the Santa Ana winds in Southern California, and it isn't just weather forecasters who talk about it. It's part of the culture here. Everything from Raymond Chandler's detective novels.
It was one of those hot, dry Santa Anas that come down through the mountain passes and curl your hair, make your nerves jump and your skin itch.
To the CW's crazy ex-girlfriend.
And it's probably just the weather.
But we don't have weather here.
We have the Santa Ana winds. Just like that weatherman said. They're the worst. They give me bad allergies, and people act weird during them, too. They call them the devil winds.
There are all kinds of references. It's kind of amazing the extent to which these winds have entered into popular culture and literature and movies.
Alex Hall is a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UCLA. He says the Santa Ana winds are a weather condition that only exists in this part of the country.
There are these very strong, dry and hot winds that start to blow right around October. They can kick up really big fires, and that creates a kind of apocalyptic atmosphere sometimes here in Los Angeles.
So what's the science behind the wind's apocalyptic atmosphere?
They are formed when there happens to be a high-pressure system sitting over this big desert that's in the interior of the western U.S., and that air wants to get out of there. So it flows through all the mountain passes that separate the coastal plain in Los Angeles from the desert, and that air is funneled through those passes, and it produces pretty high winds.
All those high winds need is a small ignition event near some fuel to spark a fire.
The Santa Ana winds are a big reason why right around now tends to be the peak fire season in Southern California.
But they aren't all bad. You know those warm breezes we get in Southern California during the winter? Well, we have the Santa Anas to thank for that, too.
They think of them when they happen in October because they're so hot at that time, but they're going on all the time in the winter.
As we approach October's midpoint, Hall says the Santa Anas are a force both scientific and cultural that are unfortunately deadly.
It's a very different experience when they're kicking up fire in October and they're producing a lot of smoke and people are in danger. And throughout the rest of the season, it's just really beautiful Los Angeles wintertime weather. I think most people just don't think of them as the same thing, but they really are.
Hello, Santa Ana winds begin to blow.
Thanks to UCLA's Alex Hall, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences, for helping us explain the Santa Anas. Moving on, the private aerospace company SpaceX was playing host to the Federal Space Agency earlier this hour. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine was touring the Hawthorne facility in advance of the country's first privately flown space mission with human beings. SpaceX founder and chief engineer Elon Musk held a press conference moments ago with two of the NASA astronauts that'll be flying on board Musk's Crew Dragon spacecraft. Take Two's Sue Carpenter is at SpaceX headquarters. Hello, Sue.
Hey, how are you?
Good, good. All right, so headline, Sue. What's the big news coming out of today's event?
The big news. NASA is going to be sending American astronauts on American spacecraft to the International Space Station in the first part of next year. So Bridenstine was saying that if all the testing goes right, it would actually be the first quarter of 2020, and that is going to be the first time that's happened since 2011, that's when NASA retired its space shuttle program. So today, Jim Bridenstine, he was touring SpaceX headquarters just to check in on the company's progress, make sure everything was going well. And they brought along two astronauts that are actually going to be on board this crewed test flight to the space station on the SpaceX Crew Dragon spacecraft.
Now, NASA's working with two private companies to send astronauts into space, the other being Boeing. SpaceX has been a NASA contractor for years now and has already run 18 resupply missions to the International Space Station. But the relationship, Sue, has been described as fractious. What's going on?
Well, you would not know that from today, but the dispute even a couple of weeks ago is that NASA was saying that SpaceX or Elon Musk was a little bit too distracted with his ambitions to go to Mars within the next decade. And Elon Musk was saying that NASA has too many safety precautions. But today, I would say they were super chummy, even jokey together. And Bridenstine was saying he had every confidence that in the coming months, SpaceX hardware would be delivered to Cape Canaveral. So SpaceX, as you mentioned, has run several resupply missions to the International Space Station, including a successful test of the first demo version of its Dragon Crew capsule, which is what the astronauts are going to be traveling in, that successfully docked with the International Space Station in March and returned. But in April, that same spacecraft exploded. There have been some issues with the parachutes, so there's more testing that needs to happen. But I would say that it seems to be on track, and they seem to be working together really well.
You know, Sue, I remember watching the great film, The Right Stuff. Why isn't NASA sending astronauts into space anymore?
Well, they retired their space shuttle program in 2011, so NASA has been buying seats on the Russian Soyuz rockets. That's been the only way that the astronauts have been able to get to the International Space Station since 2011. And I think the price tag he put on that for every time that they have to work with the Russians, and they said it's actually a really great relationship that supersedes geopolitics, I think it's about $85 million.
We're talking to Take-Two's Sue Carpenter. She's talking to us from the SpaceX headquarters in Hawthorne. Now, SpaceX had a successful test launch of the Crew Dragon capsule at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida in March. There weren't any people on board. So what are the next steps for the company as it prepares to send people, real people, to the International Space Station?
I think my favorite quote from the day was from Elon Musk, and he said, "Space is hard." So basically, they have to do some more propulsion tests. They have to do some parachute tests because those haven't been working so well. They have to do something called an in-flight abort test. That's the uncrewed flight that precedes the one that actually has the astronauts on it. And that's probably going to take place in late November or early December. But by end of December, Musk is saying that the hardware is going to be delivered to the Cape.
Now, SpaceX is one of two companies working with NASA to send astronauts to the International Space Station. How far along is Boeing, the other company?
So Boeing expects to carry out its pad abortion test for its Starliner commercial crew vehicle in early November, followed by an uncrewed orbital flight in mid-December. That's what a company executive said just a few days ago. The company's been targeting a December 17th launch of its Starliner vehicle on a United Launch Alliance Atlas V, also from Cape Canaveral. I can't even say that
Canaveral,
word.
Canaveral, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for correcting me, A. So anyways, that is a little bit later than SpaceX.
All right. Well, I'm waiting to win that lottery so I can book myself one of those tickets. Either Boeing or SpaceX, doesn't matter. I'll take either one. That's Take-Two Sue Carpenter talking to us from SpaceX headquarters in Hawthorne. Sue, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, please don't tell me you missed any part of today's show because it was a good one. In case it did, though, just go wherever you get your podcast. There we will be. Take Two will be looking right back at you, smiling, waiting to be listened by you, by your ears. You can also find us on social media. We're on Twitter, at Take Two. That's at Take Two. You can find me there as well, your pal, A. Martinez, at A. Martinez LA. That's A. Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.